This is Free Speech Radio News for Thursday, June 17, 2004. I'm Nell Abram. The September 11th Commission concludes their hearings today with descriptions of rampant communication failures on the morning of the attacks. Muslim groups protest the detention of a U.S. citizen in Saudi Arabia. The British Inspector of Prisons says asylum seekers detained in the U.K. are harshly treated. And hundreds of Somalis demonstrate at the federal courthouse in Columbus, Ohio. But first, these news headlines.
I'm Randy Zimmerman with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. More than a dozen not-for-profit hospitals are being accused of overcharging uninsured patients in violation of their obligations as a charity. From KFAI in Minneapolis, Carrie Byron reports.
The hospitals named in yesterday's lawsuit say they are not responsible for the uninsured, but lawyers contend that because the hospitals have received tax-exempt status and other benefits, they are obligated to provide health care affordable to the uninsured. Claimants point to significantly higher rates charged to patients without health insurance than those with coverage. In one hospital in Chicago, uninsured patients were charged $50 million per year more than their covered counterparts. Spokespeople for the hospitals say that those rates simply are not reflecting the negotiated lower prices achieved by insurance companies. Complaints have been lodged against some of the largest hospitals in the Minneapolis, Chicago, and Atlanta metropolitan regions, some of which are described in the suits as being among the most profitable in the country. Lawyers are asking to be awarded federal class action status, and more claims are expected. From KFAI in Minneapolis, this is Carrie Byron for Free Speech Radio News.
The United Nations International Atomic Energy Agency is admitting that they wrongfully accused Iran of withholding information. Heather Risby has the story from the UN.
The International Atomic Energy Agency had earlier reported that Iran had failed to inform it about importing magnets for producing weapons-grade uranium. Admitting the mistake, a senior UN official said today the agency had omitted to take notice of the oral statement Iran made in January. However, the agency continues to criticize Iran for lack of cooperation and transparency in reporting on its nuclear program. Many Iranian leaders, including President Mohammad Khatami, have sharply reacted with a warning that continued criticism of Iran could jeopardize its cooperation with the nuclear agency. In Vienna, the United Kingdom, Germany, and France are pressing the IAEA to adopt a resolution which deplores Tehran's record of cooperation. Iran has accused the three of working for Washington. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Heather Rizvi at the United Nations.
The state of Maryland is set to execute a person for the first time in 5 years. Tom Gomez has more.
By a vote of 6-3, the United States Supreme Court yesterday struck down the stay of execution given to convicted killer Stephen Okun just hours earlier. Okun's execution will be the first carried out in the state of Maryland in over 5 years. At a recent event to call for an end to the death penalty, Phyllis Prentice read a letter from Stephen's mother, Davita Okun.
I realize that it may be difficult for people to see and understand what having a son on death row for 8 years has done to my life and the life of my family, as we too have become victims, silent victims, suffering through the stigma of being associated with state sensationalized violence. Stephen regrets so much and is so profoundly sorry for the unspeakable acts he committed. The killing, a troubled man who really needed psychiatric help, does not show that killing is wrong. We cannot kill the ills of our community. Times are changing, and I'm certain there will be an end to the death penalty in this country one day soon.
Death penalty opponents gathered again last night before the ruling by the court was announced, this time to rally in front of the prison where Okun is scheduled to die. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Tom Gomez.
A California senator wants George W. Bush to get rid of any member of the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, the FERC, who refuses to side with consumers. Kelly Aramaras reports from Oakland.
The letter by Senator Barbara Boxer, Democrat of California, asks Bush to instruct FERC to agree to refund $8.9 billion to California. Boxer also wants FERC to renegotiate high-cost energy contracts she asserts were negotiated by California under duress during the 2000-2001 energy crisis. FERC wants California to refund $270 million to Enron and other energy traders that purchased power from the state during the energy crisis at spot prices FERC now says were too high. but audio tapes obtained by CBS News show that the high spot prices were at least in part created by the energy traders themselves.
What we need to do is to help in the cause of downfall California. You guys need to pull your megawatts out of California on a daily basis.
California Attorney General Bill Lockyer is seeking reversal of FERC's refund order. For FSRN, I'm Kelia Ramirez in Oakland, California.
And I'm Randy Zimmerman for Free Speech Radio News.
The 9/11 Commission wrapped up their hearings today on Capitol Hill. Testimony indicated that some senior U.S. officials, including Vice President Dick Cheney, first learned of the attacks from televised reports. Witnesses described communication failures between the Northeast Air Defense Sector of the North American Aerospace Defense Command, or NORAD, and the Federal Aviation Authority that hampered the U.S. military's ability to prevent hijacked planes from hitting targets. Karen Mitchell attended the hearings.
Military officials and lawmakers testified that communications failures between the military and the FAA, as well as a lack of clear protocol regarding how to respond to suicide hijackings within the United States, played a large role in the defense system's inability to prevent any of the four hijacked planes from reaching their targets. Both FAA officials and, they say, Vice President Cheney learned the U.S. was under attack through television media coverage and not through military intelligence. Officials also pointed to breaks in the chain of command, preparedness, and a lack of quick decision-making during an emergency, poor technology, training, and protocol unequipped to handle the unprecedented demands of September 11. According to NORAD, military fighter planes were in a holding position in the skies of Manhattan after planes hit the World Trade Center, but pilots were not aware that a multiple hijacking was in progress. Cheney reportedly delivered a command to shoot down suspect commercial aircraft, but his command was intercepted, so the fighter pilots, though in the air, not only did not know where to look for a plane, but did not know they had permission to shoot down a commercial aircraft. President George Bush, located on Air Force One, was reportedly unable to conference into the joint call between the FAA, White House, and NORAD to handle U.S. response during the attacks. The FAA says they knew the Pennsylvania flight was hijacked, but added that the flight was plowed into the ground by the time NORAD was told the plane was hijacked. The FAA representative on the call had no decision-making power or pertinent information to solve a hijacked situation. Plus, NORAD, dependent upon the FAA skies, lacked the technology to take full and immediate control of the skies.
It's still confusing to me from the records of our staff at the tactical level who really was in charge, whether it was NORAD or whether FAA saw it as the NMCC, whatever the NMCC is as an entity.
Be included
but
on this
how long was FAA out of connectivity to this conferencing?
Sir, I couldn't tell you. I don't know how long. I know that they were intermittently in. Most of the time they were not in the conference.
They were not in. And right. Do you think that interfered with NORAD learning about 93, which was a pretty critical failure of the
I can't speak to that specific flight, sir, but I can say that it did hamper information flow.
Senators Benveniste, Jamie Gorelick, and Bob Kerry asked officials whether military intel was informed of a possible terror attack during the summer of 2001. Commissioner Benveniste questioning General Richard Myers, Chairman Joint Chiefs of Staff for the United States Air Force.
The PDB memo that I'm referring to specifically mentions FBI information of suspicious activity within this country consistent with the preparations for hijackings. Was that information shared with you?
Not information at least that I saw.
Pentagon survivor April Gallup has been following the 911 hearings and was at the National Transportation Safety Board today where the final 911 hearings took place. April Gordon.
Here we had people whose responsibility was to protect the air, among a number of other things. Of course, we can get it on paper what their job was, and they failed to do their job. Yet, there's no call for possible impeachment hearing. There's no court-martial or official inquiry, no line-of-duty investigations done regarding the military. I mean, they did AAR reports, but where's the evidence on that? and then they get promoted to higher positions. Now, what is the likelihood of that happening? Officially, in some capacity, they should have been held accountable for their failures in their duties. And, of course, I'm starting to feel like it's a pass-the-buck moment. You know, well, it wasn't really my job. What I did was I delegated to this person. Oh, but my mind really can't recollect the whole event. I mean, now we're moving into the Oliver North, you know, incident. A lot of times when we hear, well, I don't recall, we go back to the Oliver North testimony. And to me, you know, it's just, again, an obvious show of waste of money.
A final report by the National Commission on Terrorist Attacks Upon the United States will be issued next month. I'm Karen Mitchell reporting from Washington, D.C.
The New York Times reports Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld ordered an Iraqi detainee be hidden from Red Cross inspectors last November. Today, human rights groups called on the Bush administration to disclose the location of detainment sites worldwide and grant the Red Cross full access. And as Mitch Jezerich reports, Muslim groups protested outside the State Department demanding the release of U.S. citizen Ahmed Abu Ali, who has been detained in Saudi Arabia without charge.
About 40 people, mostly Muslims, demonstrated outside of the State Department on Thursday afternoon, calling for the release of 23-year-old U.S.-born citizen Ahmed Abu Ali from Saudi Arabian detention. Abu Ali, who was born in Texas and grew up in Virginia, was studying Islam when he was detained in Saudi Arabia a year ago. Abu Ali has not been charged with a crime, and Saudi officials say they would release him if requested by the U.S. Abu Ali's family says the State Department told them it would ask for his release. However, that was a month ago, and no request has been made. Tasneen Abu Ali is his sister.
Ahmed actually graduated valedictorian of his class here in the U.S., and he went to Saudi Arabia on a full scholarship to study Islamic sciences at Medina University.
How was it that he was apprehended in the first place?
Right. He was taking his final exams, and Saudi police came in and arrested him while he was in the middle of his final exam.
What has been the word from the State Department?
Well, it's been a year. You know, it's been a year. Ahmed has been held without charge. And for an American citizen to languish in a foreign jail for that long, that just demonstrates to us that our government is not caring and is not interested in securing Ahmed's rights and securing his safety.
How do you think he's been treated over there in Saudi custody?
Well, what I really recommend is that people go and read the State Department's report on human rights in Saudi Arabia, and they will surely realize what kind of things go on in Saudi prisons.
The New York Times reports that last November, Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld, at the request of former CIA Director George Tenet, illegally ordered an unnamed Iraqi detainee to be hidden from the International Committee of the Red Cross. Also, the group Human Rights First reported on Thursday that there are over 14 secret U.S. detainment facilities worldwide, including in Pakistan, Jordan, and on U.S. ships at sea, none of which are open to Red Cross inspections. And on Wednesday, Amnesty International called for a special counsel to investigate all the alleged reports of abuse. Jumana Musa is with Amnesty International.
As more evidence comes out, it's seeming to appear that there is more and more official complicity in this. And in addition, there's a number of questions that have still gone unanswered. We have a lot of concerns about both the detainees that we know about, whether it's people being held in Guantanamo Bay, people being held at Bagram Air Base and Abu Ghraib and other detention facilities in Iraq, or people we've heard rumored being held on ships, being held in, handed over to places like Jordan and Morocco. And again, it's very difficult to confirm because there's been little transparency or accountability in this area. It's been a huge concern.
Saifullah, a citizen of Pakistan and a U.S. green card holder, worked in the apparel industry throughout Asia and the United States. A year ago, Fula disappeared on a business trip to Thailand. It wasn't until 2 months later that his wife heard through the Red Cross that he was at the U.S. detention facility Bagram Air Force Base in Afghanistan, where he remains without having been charged. Free Speech Radio News spoke by telephone with his wife, Farhat Paracha, who is in Karachi, Pakistan.
For more than a month, I had no knowledge at all where my husband was, if he was alive or dead, in what condition he was, how he got there, why he was kidnapped, by whom he was kidnapped, who all were involved in it. I still have no idea. I don't know why he's there. No charges have been levied against him. I still don't know why he's there. And it was a very terrible time for Australia.
Paracha says what worries her most is her husband's health because he has diabetes, and through the Red Cross, she discovered that he lost a significant amount of weight. On Thursday, the first ever case against a U.S. civilian for detainee abuse was opened up as a CIA contractor was arrested and charged for the 2003 murder of an Afghani detainee. Mitch Jezerich, Free Speech Radio News.
Amid allegations of the abuse of Iraqi prisoners by British troops, a report published yesterday by the British Chief Inspector of Prisons shows that asylum seekers detained in the UK's special privately run detention centers do not fare much better. Naomi Fowler brings us this report from London.
Britain locks up around 20,000 asylum seekers each year in detention centres, including children. This latest report from the Chief Inspector of Prisons came as a result of an unannounced inspection after their first highly critical report was ignored. The report concludes that Lindholm Detention Centre is not an appropriate place to hold immigration detainees. Charlie is an asylum seeker from the Democratic Republic of the Congo.
You know, when I was in my country, I could not believe that even in this country something like that can happen, because they used to talk about human rights, a lot of things, but when I was in detention, there is no human rights. You know, before I got to detention center, I was in a cell at the police station for 3 days. For 3 days, I didn't take a bath. I asked even for some water in a glass, and they didn't give it to me. I'm not a criminal. No water for 3 days. It's not easy. After 3 days in cell, and then they took you, and you don't know where you are going. They don't tell you where you are going. They just locked you in a van, and you just go. So there is no human right. When you are asylum seeker, there is no human rights.
One firm of lawyers, Birnberg Pierce, which represents asylum seekers, says it's receiving a new allegation of abuse every day from those locked up in the centres. Refugee support groups and NGOs have been alleging systematic physical, mental and verbal abuse for some time. Author of Open Borders, Teresa Hayter.
I'm afraid it's what we've been observing for the last 10 years of campaigning against the removal centre, it's now called. We hear constantly of racist abuse from the Group 4 private security guards who the government uses to run these places. And they are just very racist and sometimes actually violent. There have been a lot of civil actions, but as far as I know, there have been no convictions or charges against guards.
Immigration lawyer Dele Igbinedian explains one of the problems with outsourcing detention services to private companies.
People are getting to know, and it's really horrifying people when they get to hear about what's going on in some of these prisons. And mainly because some of these prisons, because prisons they are, even if they call them detention centers, are being run by private security organizations who are basically not accountable like the government is accountable. They are profit organizations, so their aim is just to get some money, and they don't care how they get it. You know, so they don't owe a public duty to anybody. I believe that the government cannot say that it's not aware, you know, of the things that are going on there. I think it's more a question of not wanting to listen, not wanting to hear.
But for many, the fundamental issue to be addressed is why over 42,000 people last year came to Britain seeking asylum in the first place. Campaigner and co-founder of the Refugee Project, Nick Hildyard.
Rather than scapegoating the victims of forced migration, we should be looking at those who are responsible for the forced migration. And Britain holds a massive responsibility. We have government departments, 50% of whose business is supplying arms to repressive regimes and the like. The same government is also a massive funder of infrastructure projects that displaced people, and many of these projects are carried out with little or no thoughts of the human rights implications. These people should be held to account.
This is Naomi Fowler in London for Free Speech Radio News.
Hundreds of Somalis rallied in front of the federal courthouse in Columbus, Ohio yesterday in support of Nuruddin Abdi. The Somali man was indicted on Monday on 4 federal charges and accused of plotting to blow up a Columbus-area shopping mall. Evan Davis reports that Mr. Abdi's supporters say the charges are unfounded and politically motivated.
Nuruddin Abdi, the Somali man accused of conspiring with self-described al-Qaeda supporter Ayman Faris to blow up a shopping mall somewhere in Columbus, appeared in court yesterday for a competency hearing. Mr. Abdi was arrested nearly 7 months ago due to alleged irregularities with his immigration documents. On Monday, Attorney General John Ashcroft announced that a secret grand jury has issued 4 federal indictments against Mr. Abdi, including an allegation that he traveled to Ethiopia to receive what Ashcroft called military-style training. But many in and out of the Somali community here who have known Mr. Abdi and his family say he has always been a peaceful man who abhors violence. Abdishakui Ibrahim spoke on the courthouse steps on behalf of a local support committee, Justice for Nuruddin.
Nuruddin is known by the Somali community here to be a good man, decent human being, a good father, good communitarian. He loved this country, his community, and he volunteered his time. He was a Sunday school teacher, helped Somalis all around Columbus to translate, helped them find jobs, housing and services that are available to them.
Zahra Hassan, a cousin of Mr. Abdi's, expressed disbelief with the allegation that Nuruddin was plotting to destroy a mall.
He's a family man. He has 3 kids. His wife is pregnant. He lives in Columbus. He has his own business. His mother is here. I shop at the malls.
I'm his sister.
I'm his cousin. Why would he blow people up and blow a mall with innocent people in there when his wife could be probably shopping in there?
The federal judge ordered a psychiatric evaluation for Mr. Abdi, who observers say he appeared to be incoherent during the proceedings. Mr. Abdi was represented in court by attorney Mahirti Sharif, who described his condition.
They took him, a healthy man. He is now a broken man.
Sasha, another cousin of Abdi's, was astonished at the changes in Abdi's mental state. She had not seen him since his arrest last November.
The man that I saw that day and the man that I saw today is totally... I have no idea what happened.
Jad Humedin, executive director of the Council on American Islamic Relations Ohio chapter, has also known Mr. Abdi for years.
Obviously, something was wrong. I was just so disturbed to see him this way. It was incredible. You know, obviously, at one level or another, he has been mentally abused. And he's a loving man. He's a vibrant man. He's always been helpful in the community. And I couldn't imagine that this was the same Nuruddin that I know.
Some in the Somali and Muslim communities here regard the indictments against Abdi as part of a climate of political persecution which began after September 11, 2001. Humedin read a statement which noted that false charges have been brought against other Muslim Americans in the last year.
In the wake of recent high-profile cases of Oregon attorney Brandon Mayfield and U.S. Army chaplain Joseph Yee, 2 American Muslims held for suspicion of terrorist activities only to be found completely innocent of any wrongdoing. The recent indictment against Nuruddin Abdi naturally raises questions of whether the U.S. government is covering up its troubles in Iraq and elsewhere and reasserting the threat of domestic terrorism and again using immigrants and minorities as scapegoats.
Rukio, one of Abdi's students, explained that her teacher's arrest has caused feelings of insecurity among many Somalis.
If he's convicted and we don't agree with it, right? We're all going to get ready to leave this country because nobody feels safe. He was my teacher. If they said he's, you know, terrorist and guilty, I don't think I will stay here no longer. I go to college. I wanted to get some education, but I don't feel safe anymore.
Mr. Abdi's psychiatric treatment may take several months. In the meantime, a judge in a similar case against a Cleveland-area Muslim leader, Imam Muhammad Farwaz Darwa, yesterday threw out all of the prosecution's key witnesses. Though allegations have been made of possible terrorist connections, Darwa was only formally charged with an immigration document irregularity. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Evan Davis in Columbus, Ohio.
President Bush has refused to set a timetable to hand over ex-President Saddam Hussein to the interim Iraqi government. Bush told reporters appropriate security must be in place first, quickly adding the U.S. and Iraqi governments don't want what he called lax security. He also wants assurances that Saddam Hussein will stand trial. The Bush administration has been under pressure to press formal charges against the former dictator. The International Committee of the Red Cross announced Tuesday that the Geneva Convention mandates the United States either charge or free all prisoners of war, including Saddam, before the official handover of sovereignty to Iraq at the end of this month. As Aaron Glantz reports, such a trial could reveal the support Saddam received from Europe, America, and the former Soviet Union.
A year after the fall of Saddam Hussein, the mountains and plains of northern Iraq are still covered in landmines, buried by the former Iraqi dictator during the 1980s, when he fought a decade-long war with Iran and many battles with Kurdish guerrillas. The Red Cross has made thousands of synthetic limbs for Iraqi civilians who've lost their arms or legs tending to their sheep or fields. Hundreds more have been killed by the tiny bombs. Mohammed Abuznawi is a shepherd who lives near a minefield outside Kirkuk.
We were in the village when we heard the mines go off in the middle of the night. Over 200 sheep broke out of their pen and walked into the minefield and were killed. Then my brother went out to try to save the flock. He also died.
Iraq didn't make any of the landmines Saddam used in his wars. They were all sold to him by Italy, China, the United States, and the former Soviet Union. In northern Iraq, the Italian mine, Valmara, is still the most plentiful and the most dangerous. But the American landmine, the M-14, sold to Saddam by the administration of then-President Ronald Reagan, is also lethal. William Abdurrahman of the Kurdish demining organization Aras says the American mine is one of the most difficult to detect.
Saddam Hussein have no any mine, no any reputation, anything you haven't have. He will only they have a money and bring both in the mines and guns. He have no any mercy from his homeland. Only he have how to bring the war, how to bring the me more important, and leadership, only that have.
In 1983, Ronald Reagan removed Iraq from the U.S. government's official lists of nations that support international terrorism. The next month, he sent current Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld to Baghdad, bearing a personal letter for Saddam. A declassified note at the time read, "Saddam Hussein showed obvious pleasure with the president's letter and Rumsfeld's visits in his remarks." At the time, the United States already knew Saddam Hussein was using chemical weapons against Iranian troops and Kurdish insurgents, but Rumsfeld never confronted the dictator about his practices. Brigadier General Zeki Daoud Jaber was in charge of air surveillance and radar for the Iraqi army in the 1980s. He says the Reagan administration knew when Saddam gassed thousands of Kurdish civilians at Halabja in 1988, but said nothing.
We have a strategic situation. If the Iran army outside the border, we fight them by all the normal forces. But if any penetration from the army inside our territory, we will shoot him by the chemical. United agree about this at this time.
Nobody said anything?
No. In the world, no. All of them, no speak about anything. After 10 years, after we enter Kuwait, they said that Iraqi have a chemical.
With a possible trial date drawing near, it's still not clear whether Saddam's international backers will be called as part of a war crimes trial. The Bush administration picked prosecutor Salem Chalabi, nephew of former CIA asset Amit Chalabi, has not detailed any of the specifics of his case. Saddam's defense attorney, Jordanian lawyer Mohammed al-Rashdan, is threatening to sue the United States because he has not been allowed to see his client. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Aaron Glantz.
Free Speech Radio News is produced at Pacifica Stations WBAI in New York, KPFA in Berkeley, and KPFK in Los Angeles, and community radio station WMNF in Tampa, Florida. Our producers are Simba Rousseau, Monica Lopez, and Deepa Fernandez. The headlines editor is Randy Zimmerman. Our DC editor is Mitch Jezerich. Our technical production team includes Jade Paget-Seekins, Pauline Bartolone, Mick Millian, and Lindsay Benedict. Free Speech Radio News is a worker-run collective. To find out more or for archives of the newscast, go to www.fsrn.org. I'm Nell Abram.